EFF. He's senior staff attorney and a fellow at Stanford Law School Center for Internet and Society. His specialty is free speech and privacy law with focus on government surveillance. Okay, listen up, focus on government surveillance. I know you're going to want to hear all this. He's currently lead counsel in EFF's lawsuit against the NSA, okay, the National Security Agency. He will be happy to share with you some of more about what's going on there. We're going to give you 10 minutes. Chris Conley is on the end. He is from the ACLU. He's a Technology and Civil Liberties Fellow at ACLU Northern California. He's an attorney and a computer scientist, so a rare combination. And Tracy Rittenberg, right in the middle, she's going to be our keynote speaker at about 5:30, is from Media Alliance. And Media Alliance has been a big supporter of Indy Media. She is an executive director, and she'll tell you more about what that's all about. Okay, let's get everybody forward for this panel, this very important panel. And I don't start until we've got your full attention. So Karen and Zach can come and sit in the front. Zach and Karen, come sit in the front. We need to get this show on the road. I'm the bossy granny today, all right? Everybody up front, we're going to get this baby on the road. Socializing starts at 8 p.m. We have to be out of here at 6:30, okay? For sure, because our people are coming with this kick-ass sound system for the bands tonight, which includes DJ Club and Public Frenemy, and Annie Falcon's going to be here, a whole bunch of other bands. When we're all settled down, we'll get going here. Chris from LAIFC is checking his. Are you recording this, Chris? All right. This is one for posterity, okay? I'm going to tell you a little bit about the NSA spying on people. Raging Granny's claim to fame is we were spied on by the National Guard. And then you can go visit our website, RagingGrannies.com, and read about that. But everybody's in danger when we've got wiretapping going on, and I think we'll start with you. I'll go and get people settled down.
I think I can...
Oh, all right. Then I will use this one. Hi, I'm Kevin Bankston. I'm a senior staff attorney at EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We are based just across the bay in the Mission District of beautiful San Francisco. And if you're not familiar with us, we are a nonprofit civil liberties organization that focuses on preserving free speech, privacy, and innovation on the electronic frontier, most notably the interweb. Most of my work focuses around fighting government surveillance. As mentioned, we are suing the National Security Agency and AT&T over the warrantless wiretapping program. Both of those cases are up in front of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals right now. But today, in honor of Indy Bay's 10th anniversary, I wanted to focus on some of our work regarding independent media online. Obviously, the internet has been a real boon to independent media producers and consumers everywhere. But as some of our work has shown, the ability to take advantage of those tools can sometimes be at risk, and it's actually a quite fragile right that we're all relying on when we produce or consume media, independent media, online. So to give you an example of the kind of work we've done in this area, I'm going to ultimately focus on a couple cases where we've represented indie media itself, or aspects of indie media. We have protected software coders' rights to publish software online, whether it's, say, software to help you encrypt your communications for privacy, or software to decrypt DVDs so that you can excerpt scenes from DVDs to make fair use of them. We've successfully fought Apple Computer when it tried to uncover the anonymous sources of tech bloggers who were publishing about an upcoming Apple product. We got using California's Shield Law and the First Amendment and privacy laws to protect Apple from being able to subpoena that tech blogger's emails in a way that would reveal his sources. We successfully fought to keep WikiLeaks online a couple of years ago when a court had rather precipitously taken down the entire domain of WikiLeaks.org based on a complaint from a Swiss bank whose internal documents have been published on the site. We have successfully fought countless attempts by powerful corporate interests to unmask anonymous critics online, and particularly of interest to independent media producers. We're currently fighting against a company called Right Haven. How many of y'all have heard of Right Haven yet so far? Well, so Right Haven is an interesting business model. They scour the internet looking for people who've made excerpts of news articles from newspapers. And then they go to the newspaper that originally published the story and buy the right to enforce the copyright on that story, and then sue whoever has published excerpts from that story online, even if the purpose is criticism or informing the public or some other fair use. And so they've sued over 100 websites now and made it into a little cottage business where they shake you down. You can pay $2,000 or $3,000 to make them go away, and you take down your page, or you come to EFF, and we fight back and countersue these guys, which is what we've done on behalf of Democratic Underground, a political commentary site, and another crime news site that has been republishing excerpts from news stories. So that's the kind of work we do. We want to protect your ability to comment on the things that are happening now. We want to protect your ability to publish. And that has, on many occasions, led us to work directly with indie media. Most notably, when I was just a pup of an EFF lawyer back in 2004, there was the story of the mysterious missing indie media servers. There were a couple servers called Ahimsa 1 and Ahimsa 2 sitting in a Rackspace facility in London that one day just disappeared from the internet. Over 20 different indie media centers were affected. All of their material had gone offline. Several internal indie media archives of email also disappeared. And when concerned media folk complained to the company, Rackspace, which is based in San Antonio, all Rackspace was willing to say was, well, this was the result of us complying with a court order, and we are gagged from telling you anything more than that. So indie media came to us at EFF, said, hey, our speech has been taken down for no apparent reason. We can't find out what the heck is going on. Can you please help us? And this looked like a very serious case to us. Obviously, a lot of protected First Amendment speech had just disappeared, apparently due to some government action. And so we filed a motion to unseal in the Texas court where the Rackspace company is based, hoping that that court might have some indication of what happened and maybe even was the court that issued the order that resulted in the servers disappearing. We guessed right. We fought a rather pitched battle over the unsealing of documents about what had happened. And what it turns out did happen showed that sometimes it's not government overreaching that's the problem. It's intermediaries who are too eager to help the government or too incompetent to help the government in a way that's not going to screw their customers over. Because what happened is this. One of the indie media sites being hosted on those servers was an Italian indie media site. And that site had been used by some Italian anarchists to post posts that claimed responsibility for planting some bombs in Italy. This concerned Italian law enforcement. They used international treaties, as they should, to seek the assistance of the U.S. government to try and get information about who posted these threats through the company Rackspace, based in Texas, from the servers in London, controlled by Rackspace and used by Indie Media. Indie Media, apparently, this is what we uncovered once we unsealed everything. Rackspace had gotten a subpoena. They had not gotten an order to take the server. The government had not been authorized to seize the server. The server wasn't actually seized. Rather, Rackspace got merely a subpoena asking for logs indicating who had published the story. Because most indie medias follow EFF's advice in their guide for online service providers, indie media doesn't actually keep IP logs reflecting who posted what stories, at least not for any meaningful period of time. So anyway, Rackspace got this subpoena and either dragged their feet or forgot about it, and then one day got a warning from the government saying, hey, you missed the due date on our subpoena, you better hurry up. Rackspace panicked. It went searching through the servers for logs that didn't exist, and not finding the IP logs, panicked and scared of what the government might do to them if they didn't comply, pulled down the servers so that they could mirror them and hand their entire contents over to the government. Something the government hadn't really even asked for. And we confirmed that the government never did search those servers. But it turns out, because of the secrecy surrounding this type of process, because of Rackspace's failure to handle this process responsibly, 20 indie media centers went down for many days, and a whole bunch of data was handed over to the government when there was no legal basis to do so. And this, I think, highlights just how much at the mercy of intermediaries independent media folk are. So it's actually a good thing when the intermediary stands up for your rights, which is what happened in another case we were involved in. Just a couple of years ago, in 2008, we were contacted by the administrator of IndieMedia.us, which aggregates a bunch of indie media stories from all the different indie media centers across the country. And they came to us saying, well, we're not sure we're allowed to talk to you, but we need to talk to somebody. We just got a subpoena from a prosecutor, a federal prosecutor in Indiana, asking us to hand over the IP or Internet Protocol address of every single person that has visited the IndieMedia.us site on a particular day. This shocked us for a variety of reasons. First off, what kind of investigation ever would it be relevant for the government to know the IP address of every single person who visited any page on this national independent media site? However could that be relevant to an investigation? How could that ever not be a fishing expedition that violates the rights of all these people to anonymously read First Amendment protected speech? And then this gag was also really, really disturbing. They got this subpoena, and the fact is, the government can't order you not to reveal a subpoena. In some cases, a court can, but the government's prosecutors can't, and that's why typically a subpoena will say, we please request that you don't tell anybody about this because it might hurt our investigation. This prosecutor in Indiana had taken the standard form and apparently taken out request and replaced it with require in a bald attempt to frighten the recipient of this subpoena to never tell anybody about it. So we took the case, we pushed back to the prosecutor, we said, okay, first off, the authority you're citing doesn't let you get all these IP addresses. We also don't think the First Amendment lets you get all these IP addresses. And hey, what's with this bogus gag order that you clearly don't have the authority to impose? And they backed down. They said, you're right, we don't have any right to tell you not to talk, and we are withdrawing the subpoena for all those IP addresses. Thank you very much. A minor victory, and more interesting for how it illuminates how these secret processes can be abused, can be overused, can lead to the violation of people's privacy and First Amendment rights. I just want to say thank you to the independent media community for providing clients for us. We've enjoyed our time working with the indie media community before in the previous two cases. And we can only wonder what the neat issue is going to be when you represent you a third time, because certainly it's going to happen. Anyway, thank you very much. And who will be our next speaker?
I guess I will.
I guess you will be. Excuse me.
No, I won't be. Stop that.
All right. It is a delight to introduce to you a terrific, devoted media worker, Tracy Rosenberg, Director of Media Alliance, is that the proper title? Director of Media Alliance for the Bay Area, a wonderful organization, a bridge for unifying many different groups and interests who are very concerned about media, alternative media, the takeover of the conglomeration of media, the takeover of media by larger and larger conglomerates, fighting at every level for free speech. They have been a very good friend to the people who believe in the mission of Pacifica and KPFA Blue Hill to really be an unfettered, non-corporate alternative to the military industrial corporate complex. Tracy is engaged now in fighting for all of us to make sure that KPFA remains strong and free, and she has stood very strong for the radical programs and the important, some of the very important programs that have been ignored, you know, like Hard Knock Radio, like the apprenticeship program, you know, like Full Circle. So we appreciate that kind of support. We love you to give her a terrific welcome here to this 10th anniversary of the very special independent media movement. Tracy Rosen.
Hi, everybody. So, internet security and internet privacy. I think part of the reason that I was asked to speak on this panel, and part of the reason that I said yes, was that I recently joined a sort of a national cybersecurity working group. I got called and asked to do it, and we try to work on these things. And they asked me, and I said, oh, you know, that's kind of heavy-duty, wonky policy stuff for attorneys. That's not for an advocate like me. And they said, no, it's exactly for an advocate like you. Please join us. And I'm learning, and the stuff that I'm learning is curling my hair. So basically what I think one of the most subversive things you can possibly do when you're dealing with policy stuff is translate the stuff into frickin' English and tell people what it means and tell people what's going on. So I just wanted to talk about a couple of things I found out recently because they've set me and I think they might have set you too. So I'm going to talk about four sort of things, four pieces of crap rotating around Washington, D.C. How else to say it? One is the idea of a trusted identity and how that's going to play out. And what does that mean? Most of the time when you're on cyberspace, you can be anybody that you want. You can make up a name. You can call yourself after a piece of household furniture, a celebrity, whatever you want to do. You type in an address. You type in a phone number. Maybe it's the right one. Maybe it's not. This can be used to do kind of skanky things on the internet, but it can also be used to protect your right to say something freely and something controversial. What we're finding as time goes by is that online commerce and interaction, otherwise known as capitalism, is being used as an excuse to push forward less and less privacy for internet users. In other words, your ability to participate in online banking, your ability to buy crap for your niece's birthday, your ability to participate in those major social media sites that we all hate and many of us belong to, if you do not only provide your personal data, but verify your personal data, you will not be a trusted or a known entity on the internet. And if you are not a trusted and known entity on the internet, your participation may be somewhat curtailed in certain venues. The unsophisticated version of this, in quick language, is a driver's license for the internet. It's a possibility. Another thing that sort of has been out there recently, although happily it died, although it will probably come back, is the idea of a cyber emergency. What's going to happen if there is a vast cyber emergency in this country? One answer that came up, it was in something called a Rockefeller Snow Bill, was casually referred to as an internet kill switch. And that's exactly what it sounds like. It means in Washington, when there's an emergency, they could turn it off. And if you think about that for a second, what do we need in an emergency? I mean, what do we need in the event of a horrible attack? What we need, they say, is the lack of the ability to communicate. I would question that. That's probably not the primary thing that we need. So the internet kill switch was removed from the cybersecurity bill, but it will probably come back in some form or another. Okay, there's two more things that I wanted to mention. One is sort of an abuse of a very wonderful scientist called Albert Einstein. And the use of his name has been used to sort of cover the sort of U.S. Computer Emergency Management Readiness System. We're now developing or in the process of implementing Einstein 3. We've been through versions 1, 2, and 3. So what does that mean? Einstein monitors all network activity to and from all federal agencies. I'm not just talking about the Pentagon or the Homeland Security or the NSA or the obvious ones that you would think about. I'm talking about Social Security. I'm talking about welfare. I'm talking about education. There are, in the corner of all these websites, little banners. They're required by the Office of Management and Budget, and they say that any user consents to having all of their traffic monitored. And so it is. If you think about what that means outside of the public sector, where it's a done deal, you have to think, well, couldn't this make its way to the private sector? Well, sure it could. It could be an ISP selling point that they provide Einstein-level surveillance. We may have sort of high-class, expensive, Blackwater-type cybersecurity firms that offer military-type cyber protection. There's a lot of things out there that are potentially scary. Finally, on the other side of it, there was a bill that recently didn't go anywhere, although it lived in the Senate with the senator who is now our president. It's called the Voter Intimidation Protection Act of 2007. The Voter Intimidation Protection Act was addressing some hacking, some destructive hacking, some right-wing hacking. There were messages that went out helpfully telling voters that if they were Republicans, they should vote on Tuesday, otherwise known as Election Day. If they were Democrats, it would be best to vote on Wednesday. This went out in parts of the South. There were people that fell for it, no doubt about it. So the question becomes, is there a responsibility of some entity, some public entity, to protect us from fraud, intimidation, from African internet scams, from cyberbullying, from this kind of stuff, the vote on Wednesday instructions? Is there a need to authenticate things as credible, whether they're spoof sites or not, or do we leave it up to people to figure that out for themselves? Is this ever necessary under any set of circumstances? And then, of course, we hear about child exploitation and saving the children is usually what follows from that. So these are sort of some things that have been passing through the sort of Washington environment, and I think it's important to know that they're out there. It's important to know because things tend to go around for a long time and then come back in various other forms. And it's important to understand them because they're going to affect everything that we do from an information and communication standpoint going forward. It's a mess. There are currently 35 bills in 25 different House and Senate committees. The good news is that the so-called experts probably don't know what should be done any more than you do. Having sat in on a meeting with, you know, some very officially important people, I would have to say some of the questions were not so different than my own. So I think what's important here is pay attention to this stuff. Pay attention, and if you don't understand what some wonky piece of crap means, find out because it matters. And everyone else is doing it too, and support advocacy organizations like MediaLines that are trying to have an impact and that are trying to raise public awareness about this stuff. Because it is important, because it isn't stopped by a bunch of lawyers in the end. It's always stopped by people and public interest and public concern and people, you know, saying, yes, I hate politics, but I'm going to pay attention to this because this matters to me. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to the next speaker or to Dennis.
Thank you very much, Tracy. Appreciate that a lot.
But lawyers are important.
Of course they are.
Because, and I can attest to that, because I think I probably still have a job because I had a very good human rights, civil liberties, employment lawyer. And the person that I am delighted to bring to you is Chris Connolly. He's with the ACLU. He works on guaranteeing your right, if I have this correct, to internet privacy. And he's working, you're working on the long haul case now?
No, we're not working on that.
But you were?
The ACLU is working on the long haul case, but I'm not going to talk about it.
Oh, okay, but you work with the ACLU, I got that right? Okay. And, well, let me then just leave it there. The ACLU did cover the long haul people.
Yes.
And we appreciate
EFF
that.
Too. Okay. EFF and ACLU teamed up to do that.
All right. Anyway, this is Chris Connolly. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you.
So thank you, Dennis. I'm going to talk for about 30 seconds about the long haul case that has been presented. So this was a case started last year where the police in Oakland, sorry, microphone closer to my mouth. There we go. This was a case where police in Oakland determined that some alleged criminal activity happened at Long Haul, which was an organization that has, in addition to public computers, a newsletter they publish and various other activities. They also rent out space to another organization that publishes a prison newsletter of missives and writings from prisoners. And the police decide to come in and seize everything in the building. Every computer, all the data, take it away, have a warrant that was incredibly overbroad, that they never bothered telling the judge that, oh, there are publications coming out of this building. And the ACLU and EFF are involved in this case, and that's all I'm going to say about it. So, again, my name is Chris Connolly. I work for the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. You may have heard of us. We're the largest and oldest civil liberties organization in the country. We have over 600,000 members, 60,000 in Northern California, and we focus on protecting constitutional rights, everything from the freedom from discrimination to voting rights to sexual and reproductive freedoms. My focus in particular is on technology and civil liberties, which is mostly about the intersection of emerging technology, privacy, and free speech. And the emerging technology I want to talk about today for my 13 minutes of fame is this. The question is, what is this? Now, is this a portable media powerhouse where you can connect with all of your independent sources, where you can mobilize and activate people anywhere they are, wherever they go? Is this a lockdown little piece of hardware where you can only do exactly what some carrier or some company tells you you're allowed to do and nothing else? Or is this a portable surveillance device where the government can watch everything you do and monitor your location, the people you know, the places you go, the things you think or want?
All of the above.
It may be all of the above. Hopefully it won't be all of the above forever. But those are my three topics. The one thing it's not anymore is just a phone. So this is not just something that people use to call each other. A third of the adults in the U.S. right now use their mobile phone to access the internet. So they use it to access websites for information about restaurants, they use it to access news and media, they use it for games, they use it for all sorts of things that is not just about calling. And interestingly, it's actually some of the less popular communities that actually use it more extensively. So minority communities use cell phones to access the internet more often. Younger people, not surprisingly, use it far more often than does the average adult to access the internet. So this has the potential to be a great outlet for independent media, for activism, for reaching the exact audiences that we're trying to get to. So it has the potential to be a wonderful device. The catch, of course, is, are you allowed to do that? And one of the big questions around that that bounces around from time to time is a topic that's called network neutrality. Roughly speaking, network neutrality is who is in charge of what happens on the device I own. Is it the person who's running the device, or is it the person who's running the network? And there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of legal congressional hearings, FCC interaction with the topic of network neutrality. One of the unfortunate things that happened recently is that the FCC was shot down in a court case that said they do not have the jurisdiction to impose rules about network neutrality on ISPs. Because they classify them as information services and not telecommunication services, legal technical jargon, they didn't have the authority to actually impose rules about equal opportunity, equal access to content, open networks, things like that. That topic is still very hot, however. So the FCC is considering reclassifying these, basically going around, if we can't do it one way, we'll do it another way. There's a lot of congressional pressure. There are companies getting more and more engaged with this. Now, the unfortunate thing, of course, is the companies are not necessarily the ones with everyone's best interests at heart. And there has been a proposal recently from a somewhat odd coalition with Google and Verizon proposing network neutrality rules in some limited fashion. One of the specific exceptions to those rules is this. So your wired internet connection would be subject to some rules that mandate fairness. Your cell phone or mobile connection would not. And that becomes a major issue. If this is such a potentially great tool for reaching out to people, we want to make sure we can actually use it, and it's not somehow categorized as a special exception. It's so hard to use, it's so hard to monitor that we have to just give carriers the right to do whatever they want to. Because we see them choose not to allow narrow pro-choice to send text messages for activism. We see them block applications like Skype that are competitors to their services. In the non-mobile context, we see them block all sorts of things, ranging from political protests at Pearl Jam concerts to, you know, competing applications and content. We have threats of we must monitor everything that goes on the network so that we can keep it secure. And this is all based on the idea that we can prioritize and monitor, and the network owner is the one who controls what happens and not the person at the end of the connection. So that's one of the major issues I see with this. Now, the other issue, and I'm going to expound upon what Kevin has said before, is the issue of privacy. So your phone is a walking compilation of everything you do and see. So it is not only location of where you are, which means you're sitting in this room with the other people in this room listening to someone from the ACO speak and EFF, the Media Alliance. It is a record of the communications you send, your text messages, your phone calls, maybe your emails and everything else. It talks about what you're interested in, what you care about, when you go to the doctor's office or church, what meetings you attend. Your life is carried in your cell phone. And the question is, what are the protections for this? Do we have real privacy rights such that our lives, using our modern technology, are protected? Unfortunately, the answer is really not so great. So the first line of protection for us is typically the Constitution. That's what the ACLU is typically about defending. And we have the Fourth Amendment, which is the right to protection from unreasonable search and seizure, which is often construed as a right to privacy. You have a privacy in your papers, in your belongings, in your records, in your documents. Unfortunately, there were some court cases about 35 years ago now that decided that if you gave records to a third party, it's called the third party doctrine, you have relinquished your interest, your privacy interest in those records. So if you make a phone call, you told the phone company who you were dialing, and so you don't have a privacy interest in that anymore. If you write a check, you told the bank who you're writing a check to, and so you don't have a privacy interest in your bank records anymore. It didn't erode everything. It doesn't mean the contents of your phone call are not private. But the number you dialed, according to this doctrine, is no longer private. Now you fast forward 35 years to the idea where we use all kinds of things to interact with third parties. Our cell phones, we send text messages and emails, and we use social networks and location-based services, and we have our running shoes that map our routes, and we have all sorts of things that we do interact with third parties. And there is a very wide open question about how well the Constitution actually protects these activities, whether we have a privacy protection in the Constitution that actually means that as we use new technology, we're not simply surrendering control of our personal information and making it wide open to government interaction and government surveillance. Now, Congress actually recognized this problem, and they said, hey, we've got this brand new technology. We're going to enact a law that will protect people so that they can interact with these computers and these databases and these newfangled things and not surrender their privacy, which was a great idea. The problem is this happened in 1986. Computers in 1986 were a little bit different than they were now. When you sent an email, it sat on some server in the cloud until someone pulled it down, and then it was gone. And so they wrote the law saying, well, if you leave an email on a server for more than 180 days, you must have abandoned it. It doesn't have the same privacy protection it has before the 180 days, because who would ever leave an email on somebody else's server for 180 days? Today, that's, of course, a silly question, too, because we all do, because we have Gmail or Yahoo Mail or whatever it is. We use technology very differently. But unfortunately, this law, again, has not been updated. It's still stuck in 1986, and we're trying to fit our new technology into these ancient understandings of what is an electronic communication system or service or a remote computing service, or what is content and what is transactional. If I do a search or if I ask for a web page, what exactly is the content? If I tell you the exact URL I asked for, well, it's not the content, but it points you right at the content. So all of these distinctions that the law understands are very blurred. And so most of my work, and also a whole lot of Kevin's work, conveniently enough, is working on reforming this law called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. So there is a coalition called the Digital Due Process Coalition, which includes both the ACLU and EFF, a number of actually right-wing organizations, the Americans for Tax Reform among them, and several companies are actually engaged in this as well, Google, Facebook, even AT&T, surprisingly enough. Because companies are also in the middle of a situation where if they have demands for records and they don't know what the law is, the only thing that's sure is they're going to pay lawyers a lot of money. Because either they're going to pay the lawyers to prevent, to resist demands for information, or they're going to pay the lawyers when we come after them when they give in to demands for information. So they can't win. So they want the law to be updated to be clearer. And so the work I do is called Demand Your .Rights Campaign, which is largely around reforming this law. So where does it all tie back with indie media? Well, it's pretty obvious. I mean, all of these things are major issues because it's about control. Your device, you should have the control over what content you receive, over what you do with your device. It shouldn't be the carrier's choice. You should have control over your own personal information. It should not be government's choice. It should not be, again, the carrier or the other side's choice. So, and the way we get that, as Tracy nicely said, is it's actually not about the lawyers. We're doing our job, but the real job to be done is by the people. We need the people to understand what the issues are, why this is important, and how these can be changed. And the best way for us to reach the people is through independent media and groups like this, because you guys tell the story as it is. You make people understand why this is important, why without net neutrality your voice may be silenced and their voice may never be heard, why privacy becomes such an essential right and how technology can erode it if we don't push the government for better law, if we don't push companies for better protection. And so I just really want to thank everyone here, not just for coming out today and staying inside and listening to us, but for all you do to make sure that people are aware of all of these issues and what they can do to have a voice. And I forgot to bring my postcards up, but we have postcards and stickers and sign-ups about this .Right campaign if you want to learn more about what we're doing and how you can engage with us to help people understand what they can do to protect their privacy and online rights.
One disclaimer here, as Chip pointed out, I made that comment about it's not about the lawyers, it's about the people, and then someone said, well, there's two lawyers sitting to the right and to the left of you. I wanted to convey, as Chip kind of implied, I said that because every lawyer I've ever spoken to has said that to me, and to pass it on. It's a partnership. The lawyers are part of it, you guys are part of it too.
Because lawyers are, in fact, people too.
And there's the moral of the story for today.
Listen, let's have some questions. A beautiful panel. But first to hand for this terrific informational Sharon. Yes. Beautiful. Questions, you can just raise your hand. I'll pick on you and you can call now. Questions? Incredible discussion here. I'll throw one out.
There's one over there,
oh,
I think.
Oh, yes.
So, drugs, usually.
Yeah.
All right, you know what? Come on up. So everybody can hear the question and we don't have any problems.
We'll be formal.
Thank you. That way.
Okay. My question is, what excuses the government can use for check your privacy life? So to go to your phone or go to your email or... When they can do that, or when they say they can do that?
So the question is, in essence, when can the government legitimately come and say, we need to inspect your email, your various information systems?
May I? It's the fact that that question is unanswered. That's why I have a job, so we can fight about it. We actually, a great deal of our work and ACLU's is opposing the government when they try to obtain someone's email or track their phone or do some other invasive surveillance without meeting the legal standards that we think they should meet, which typically is a search warrant approved by a judge, supported by a factual showing of probable cause that a crime has been committed or is being committed or is going to be committed, and particularly stating what the government is authorized to search or seize. the whether or not this search warrant requirement, which is the traditional requirement if the government wants to, say, bust into your house and take your stuff or search the things, whether or not that search warrant requirement applies to tracking your cell phone has been, because of the 35-year-old Supreme Court precedents that Chris mentioned, a big controversy in the past 5 years since we learned that the government has indeed been doing cell phone tracking without warrants. So, for example, I argued a case in front of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals just earlier this year, arguing against a government application to track a cell phone without probable cause. And we got a good ruling from that court saying that the lower court had done the right thing by using its discretion to deny the government's request. The government is now appealing that and trying to fight that ruling. We have similar fights over email, because as Chris mentioned, the federal statute right now that applies to protecting your email has some really weird features such that the government often gets email without a probable cause warrant. And so we have tried to fight that when it happens. The problem is the government keeps backing down when we try and have that fight. We've had a court in New York come to us twice saying, I have the government coming and asking me, based on this law, to get some email without a warrant. Will you brief me on it? And we say, yes, we'd love to be an adversary in that process, which is typically secret, and it's usually just the court and the government. And then we say, yes, we're going to do that, and the government finds out, and it drops the application. It avoids the fight, so it can avoid higher court rulings on whether they can get your email without a warrant. This happened again just this past summer when they were trying to get someone's Yahoo mail without a warrant in a court in Colorado. Yahoo got some of the case unsealed so that we could jump in as friends of the court. And we and ACLU and another group and Google all put in a brief saying, hey, this would be unconstitutional. This would violate the Fourth Amendment if you seize this email without a warrant. And the government said, oh, wait, you know, now that we think about it, we think we have all the evidence we want. We're going to just drop this application. We also see them avoiding appealing a lot of these phone tracking rulings. So basically, we have a situation where the law is not clear. We think warrants should apply. But whenever we get an opportunity to fight with the government and get a court decision that that's the case, they often back down because, in the end, the ambiguity serves them.
And I'll follow up on something that Kevin said earlier, which is, when does the government actually get the information? Is when somebody says yes, often. And one of the challenges right now is that because there are these unclear standards, and because there are so many different technologies sharing information, there are a lot more people to ask. If you can only ask one company, and they can be educated, and they have a reputation to uphold, we have a fighting chance. But the more this information is distributed without control, without checks and balances, and the more there are more people out there without information about what's happening, the easier it is to find someone who will just say, okay, you know, I don't know if I need to be a warrant or not, but I don't feel like finding it, and I'm going to, you know, as Kevin said, just going to overblog and give you whatever I have on hand just to get you off my case. That becomes a threat. So we need to keep working with the courts and other people to make sure that, you know, that's one real point of limit, is if they can't get the warrant or order in the first place, they don't have much to go on. But once they get that, it's a challenge to make sure that the companies are fighting back, and it's harder as more and more companies are engaging this space.
One of the things I like about interviewing lawyers is you can do a 20-minute interview in 10 minutes. You know what I mean? You can say a lot in a little space. Other questions? Come on up. So everybody can hear.
Hi, thanks for being here today. I'm Chris from LA Indie Media. One thing I was curious about was, we know that they can track cell phones. What about using them as recording devices, and have those actually showed up in court cases?
Yes.
Not only are you carrying a tracking device in your pocket in the form of your cell phone, you're also carrying an eavesdropping bug. You may not know this, but typically with the assistance of your cell phone provider, the government, ideally armed with a interception order, a super warrant for eavesdropping on you, can remotely activate the microphone on your cell phone to overhear the conversations happening near your cell phone. It is for this reason, for example, that secure U.S. government facilities don't let you bring cell phones into them, because this is a known capability. And we have indeed seen cases where this capability has been used by law enforcement. We saw it in a New York mafia case, and also an analogous case that came up in California, actually, where they did this to the OnStar or OnStar-like system in a car, the cell-based emergency response GPS system in your car, actually has a phone line. So when you run into something, it opens a line to OnStar or whoever, and you go, "Oh, help!" and OnStar can help you. And they use that mic to eavesdrop on the people in that car. And so we're basically in a technological landscape at this point where there are microphones and cameras connected to the network everywhere. And when you have a camera or a microphone and it is connected to the internet or the phone network, then it can be subverted to spy on you. We saw this in the case of laptop cameras in a case in Pennsylvania where a school had issued laptops to their students with some really nasty security software that allowed them to secretly turn on the camera, the security personnel at the school, which they in fact did when kids brought the laptops home and into their bedrooms, and without any notice to those kids. And so this is only one of the reasons why when we get our new laptops at work, our sysadmin puts a little sticky note on the camera. Now if only we had a plug for the microphone, that would be great too. But so to turn a really short answer, yes, into a long answer, yes, your microphone can be used as a bot. If you take out the battery, that should do it. Turning it off might not do it. There are ways for your phone to run silently. We do not. I would not be surprised if such a list exists, but I mean,
right.
Ultimately, even if there were such a list, if a phone weren't on it, I wouldn't take that as conclusive proof that phone can't get owned.
Yeah. The shorter list is probably the ones that can't be owned, unfortunately. Yeah. So.
And journalists have lost their life by leaving their cell phones on.
I can believe it.
Yeah.
Other questions? I have a question in the context of privacy in the workplace. Mm-hmm. If you're working and you have your job email and your personal email, does the employer have the right to come in the workplace and inspect, say, for instance, your personal email to see if you are using your email, communicating with people, wasting their time, if you will, the company time on your private email? What rights do you have in terms of the workplace and your own email?
This is a fairly unsettled area of law. It can vary from state to state, and I am a civil libertarian, not a workplace rights person. But speaking generally, your employer has a great deal of latitude to monitor what you are doing on their network or on their computer. And typically, any workplace that has a lawyer is going to get your consent to do so through their employee policy. Entering your private account without your permission, I think, would be a step too far for practically any employer and could get them into trouble under, for example, computer fraud and abuse or computer crime laws. But speaking generally, if you want to do something privately, you probably should not aim to do it on your workplace's computer or network, which is another one of the sort of freeing aspects of mobile computing, is that many people now have the opportunity to use their mobile device to do those things rather than having to rely on their workplace's computer or network.
And in terms of another employee entering your private computer, is that a violation?
It's not your private computer. It's the workplace's computer.
But, okay, got it. Other questions? This is regarding email. It's an actual experience that happened to me, but one time I sent out a confidential email to a very tight list of everybody that I know. I didn't put any type of, I made sure that it was no corporate media people or anybody that I don't trust completely. and it ended up getting to a right-wing talk show host, and I'm sure that the people didn't, you know, send it forwarded to him. So, you know, besides the government, are there, you know, people with corporations, and this guy was employed by a big Clear Channel corporation. Do they have access to technology where they can actually spy on emails that you're sending out confidentially?
I think I can do this one.
Again, I'll defer to the attorneys on the legal aspect of it, but there ain't no such thing as a confidential email. There just isn't. There's technology out there that allows emails to be intercepted in transit. It's not easy to use. It's not common to use. That's how numbers are fished out. Basically, if you put it on email, it might get out there. There's no other straightforward answer to give, as I understand it.
Other questions?
So, can the government break PGP? With what you know. The PGP is encryption.
I think.
With what you know from documents and whatnot.
Maybe. I mean, I wish I knew the NSA's capabilities, or more about them. We certainly know that the NSA has the best code breakers, you know, in the world. PGP is very strong encryption. It does have the benefit of being open source, such that security experts can audit it, as opposed to, say, the encryption used by Skype, which I would not necessarily trust. But I simply can't answer that question. And that's a sad and frightening thing. We don't know how secure even our most secure tools are against the most moneyed and powerful potential attacker there is, the U.S. government. But I'd still say use it if you have it and have the opportunity and your correspondents are using it. Because at worst, they can crack it, in which case it's no less private than it would have been if you hadn't encrypted it, and best case, they can't crack it, and it is demonstrably more private than it would have been if you hadn't encrypted it. Mm-hmm. So.
You want to start that?
I mean, I guess I would slightly disagree in that I'm sure the answer is yes, the only question is how long. And there are two questions to that. One is, how much computing power is there just to crack it through brute force, which, as technology gets more and more sophisticated, it may be feasible if you're focused on one specific email or one specific person to do that. The other question is there a shortcut that they have that they can just crack everything? And I have no idea about that one. But the brute force, it's getting to the point where PGP is old enough, technology is advanced enough, someday, if not now, it will be doable in less than lifetimes. I don't know if that's a day yet, but technology is catching up to the point to PGP where if they archive everything in PGP is going through now, someday they'll have the computing power to crack into it, even if they don't today.
Very good point.
And just this notion of the National Security Agency, the NSA, this is an extraordinary institution. 10 years ago, they had about 70,000 employees, and it's top secret even where the building is. Is top secret. Can anybody tell me the administrator of the NSA? Raise your hand. You know the CIA. We know the. I don't know. Do you? No. It's an extraordinary operation. If you want to read more about it, there's a couple of books written by. I can't remember his name. One of the books is Puzzle Palace. James Bamford, and he's got a follow-up, and it's incredible. That every CIA director that comes in thinks they're the head of a department until they realize that the NSA is the real spy agency. It's amazing. Other questions?
I have a follow-up.
Come on up.
Has there any been like weird cases where you have people who get their stuff seized that is encrypted, and they like what happens? Does it just like, oh, it's encrypted, we can't unblock it? Do they usually get like a subpoena by a court to give the password? And, like, has there been a point when like somebody just doesn't talk and they like I'm kind of just like, what are cases where encryption has been used like as extortion or as like people have beat the system by having their stuff encrypted? I guess that's my question.
I mean, this has come up in a couple cases.
This issue has come up in a couple of cases. I can't, off the top of my head, recall the specifics. We certainly would recommend encrypting your drive if you're crossing the border, because the government has a great deal of latitude to search your computer at the border, despite our best attempts in litigation. There are arguments that you can withhold your password. Actually, one of the cases that did come up is someone had refused to give their password and successfully argued that they could not be compelled to do so without violating their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. So that is one argument that would be available to you if they attempted to force you to hand over your password. But this is actually an area where there is a dearth of case law. There's not a whole lot of guidance here. Certainly, if you happen to be a person who has an encrypted drive and the government's trying to force you to hand over the password, that's a case where we'd love to hear from you, because you know, groups, organizations in this space definitely do want to set good precedents in that area. I should have mentioned this at the top. The Electronic Frontier Foundation site is at EFF.org. You can learn about all the cases that I talked about today and issues we spoke about. You can also join EFF. We are primarily member-supported. In other words, I work for tips, so appreciate whatever support you can provide. But again, that's EFF.org.
Mm-hmm.
Let's
hear, how did we get the Media Alliance?
Website is NEDIA-ALLIANCE. That's media-alliance.org.
And I get three of those. We have the National ACLU, which is at aclu.org. We have the ACLU of Northern California, which is where I work, which is aclunc.org. And our campaign for online privacy, Demand Your Dot Rights, is dotrights, that's dotrights.org.
And if people have a problem and they think they might need a lawyer, can they just send you an email or?
Information@eff.org.
Right. We have on our, I don't actually know the email address, but our website is connections to our intake line, which is where we'll talk to people with whatever's going on.
We will listen to your story and refer you to one of these fine organizations.
All right, I think we're, oh, you have a question? This will be the final question because we have to break at 5:30.
This is more directed to you. I forget your name with the ACLU. As I understand, the ACLU filed an amicus brief on behalf of Citizens United and corporations being able to buy elections, and on behalf of Nike being able to lie about whether or not their shoes are made in sweatshop factories. I was wondering if there's any way we could support your work without supporting the rest of the ACLU's work. Is there any distinction in where we're donating or what we're supporting? Or is the ACLU one big monolith that mixes the bad with the good?
Well, we are not one big monolith. We all have our different opinions, and we, as affiliate, so the ACLU has a national organization and affiliate structure. There's at least one affiliate in every state. We have three: Northern California, Southern California, and San Diego, which is not Southern California. And so that's the long answer, which is that we are not monolithic, but there is no dedicated fundraising. So if you're interested in supporting the Dot Rights campaign, you are more than welcome to do so through email, through our action items, through petitions and such. If you want to give money to the organization, it goes into the collective pot. So I can't help you with that one.
I want to thank the panel.
Yeah,
thank you. Wonderful, excellent, helpful information. We thank all three of you for spending this time and all the important work that you all
thank you.
Do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. There is a work. There are two workshops that are starting at 5:30 in the workshop area.
your personal story, writing for commentary on radio with Courtney Seppel. Is Courtney here? Yes. And also some we'll also have some here from the first voice apprenticeship program, KPFA, participating in this. Thank you, everybody. Stay around, stay at the workshop. It's going to be a party a little later. We'll take a short break now. Thanks. All right, everybody who's in this room now, will you please gather in the main room? We're going to have the keynote speech and a dialogue. Can I ask you to come in and join us now in the main room? Everybody, please come on in. I can do one of my whistles. Come on, everybody. Join us in the main room for the keynote speech. We'd love to see you. We'd love to have you join us. Hello. Come on in. All right. All right, who's ever listening, there's been a decision. We think everybody's heard enough, and you all want to keep talking to each other, and we want to talk to you too. So why don't you introduce yourself and your program. All
right. Hi, everybody. I go by Dave Id, and thank you for coming out today. I think it's been a really awesome day, really informative. And I appreciate the tablers and everybody. So I hope everybody's mingled. One of the best things we wanted to get out of this was not so much a boost for IndieBay itself, but that there would be some cross-pollinization. I know that the IWW was talking to Berkeley Liberation Radio and so forth and so on. So that's one of the biggest things, is just to bring like-minded people together to move forward for the future. So thank you, everybody, for coming out. And the tablers are free to go, and we kind of need to have people out of here by roughly 6:15 or so. So take your time, say your last hellos and goodbyes, and by 6:15 we have to clear out. And then come back, please, please, please come back for the musical portion at 8 p.m. We've got some really good bands. We've got a whole new sound system coming in here, a sound engineer. The bar is going to be open. It's 21 and up. $10 to get in the door. Tablers are free. The speakers are free. And it should be a really good show. It's just supposed to be fun, music, dancing, drinking, and we'll just all blow off some steam together.
And maybe just to close it out, could we maybe have on a count of three one last happy birthday for IndieBay?
Happy birthday!
All right, come on, let's do it together. Together, this is good. On a count of three. One, two, three. Happy birthday!